From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Jane Goodall about her 33 years studying wild chimpanzees in Tanzania. Witnessing a chimp war and being attacked by a chimp reminded her not to sentimentalize the animals. Also today, scientists believe a new strain of virus is causing the mysterious illness in the Southwest. A virus may also be behind the mysterious illness in Cuba. What's happening in the world of viruses? We talk with Yale epidemiologist Robert Shope. And world music commentator Milo Miles reviews the debut album by Pakistani singer Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. UN military officials said today that 5 UN peacekeepers were killed and at least 44 have been wounded in fighting with the forces of Somali faction leader Mohamed Farah Aidid. They said that most of the casualties were the result of sniper fire when the troops stormed Aidid's residence in an effort to arrest him. The UN has ordered Aidid's arrest on charges of crimes against humanity for allegedly obstructing the delivery of aid to hundreds of thousands of Somali citizens. Aidid is also accused of ordering the ambush that killed 23 Pakistani peacekeepers on June 5th. During a one-day meeting in Moscow, the presidents of Russia and Ukraine have reconfirmed their intention to divide up the former Soviet Black Sea Fleet. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
Ukraine and Russia are determined to form two navies out of the Black Sea Fleet's 350 ships and 70,000 naval personnel. That was the message today from the meeting between Russian President Boris Yeltsin and Ukraine's President Leonid Kravchuk. The two presidents made essentially the same pledge last August, but talks on dividing the fleet proceeded slowly and stalled altogether 2 months ago. Then the sailors took the job on themselves. Over the past several weeks, the crews of more than 200 support ships have raised the Russian naval flag, angering the Ukrainians among them. Yeltsin and Kravchuk acknowledged today that the process of dividing the fleet must be accelerated, and they also decided to share the naval facilities in Sevastopol, home port of the fleet. Sevastopol is in Ukraine, but the Russians do not now possess a comparable port on their own Black Sea coast. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
Secretary of Education Richard Riley and members of Congress introduced a bill today that for the first time will provide federal aid to fight crime and violence in public schools. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
Education Secretary Richard Riley says the Safe Schools Act of 1993 will allot $75 million to school districts with the most severe levels of violence. Riley sounded aghast at just how bad the problem is.
One out of every five high school students carries a firearm, knife, or club on a regular basis. That just shocks me to think of that. 16% of our high school seniors say they've been threatened with a weapon at school. And meanwhile, physical threats, assaults on teachers, unheard of only a few years ago, are now increasing in frequency and severity.
$75 million isn't a lot of money, but Riley and the bill's congressional sponsors predict that the competitive bidding for the money will encourage schools to look beyond metal detectors to experiment with peer mediation and conflict resolution programs that have worked in some of the toughest schools. I'm Claudio Sanchez in Washington.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 10 points today to close at 3,522. The NASDAQ Composite Index was down 0.3 points at 695.9. Advances edge declines. This is NPR. Navajo leader Peterson Zah said today that the mysterious flu-like ailment that struck people in the Southwest is causing discrimination against Native Americans. 9 members of the Navajo tribe were among the 16 killed by the illness, which has been linked to a virus carried by rodents. Zah told a news conference in Washington that the disease is not limited to Native Americans and should not be an excuse for discrimination. Zah was in Washington to lobby against proposed cuts in federal spending for Native American health services. Former Texas Governor John Connally was buried today in Austin, Texas. Billy Graham, former President Richard Nixon, and Treasury Secretary Lloyd Benson all paid their respects to the 3-term Texas governor, who died Tuesday at the age of 76. NPR's Wade Goodwin reports from Austin.
Hundreds of mourners packed First United Methodist Church to say goodbye to the man who was known across the state as Big John. Conley and his close friend Lyndon Johnson completely dominated Texas politics throughout the 1960s. Conley's charm and good looks made him one of the most popular governors the state has ever had. Congressman Jake Pickle delivered a moving eulogy recalling their college days at the University of Texas, where Conley got his start in politics running Pickle's campaign for student body president. Lady Bird Johnson and the Reverend Billy Graham remembered Conley as an icon of Texas history. 20 years ago, Conley delivered the graveside eulogy for Lyndon Johnson. Conley outlived by nearly 30 years bullets fired by assassin Lee Harvey Oswald, which were meant for President John Kennedy. Conley will be laid to rest next to Stephen F. Austin and Confederate General Albert Sidney Johnston at the State Cemetery in Austin. For National Public Radio, I'm Wade Goodwin reporting.
American workers produced less per hour of work during the first quarter of the year, the first drop in productivity in 2 years. The Labor Department said overall productivity fell by 1.6% from January through March. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Chimpanzees are the species that most closely resemble humans genetically. Perhaps that explains our fascination with chimps. In 1960, Jane Goodall began the first long-term study of wild chimpanzees at Gombe National Park in Tanzania. No one expected her project to still be going 33 years later, but Goodall's research project continues today. And she's now widely acknowledged as the world's leading expert on wild chimpanzees. She spends much of her time now on the road, on a crusade to save the wild chimpanzee, and speaking out against the cruel treatment of chimps used in lab experiments. Goodall's latest book, Visions of Caliban, co-authored with Dale Peterson, is about the relationship of humans and chimpanzees. We spoke in April, just after the book was published. When Goodall first began studying the chimps, she was discouraged from projecting human characteristics onto the animals, but she disregarded the advice.
For one thing, I gave them names instead of numbers. Terrible thing to do. For another thing, the first scientific paper I wrote, I talked about chimpanzees as he and she, and I said, this individual who, and the article came back, and it was substituted for he and she, and which was substituted for who. And then in those days, you couldn't talk about something like adolescence and childhood. You couldn't talk about motivation. You couldn't talk about excitement. There was very, very little you could do in terms of describing chimpanzee behavior in terms that ordinary people would understand.
Do you think that's changed? Do you think that your more personal style has become accepted scientifically?
I think that in most scientific circles today, these things that I've mentioned are accepted. I think people have come to realize that when we're talking about creatures who share over 98% of their genetic material with us, creatures whom we know to have very, very similar central nervous systems and brains, you know, it's completely crazy to imagine that they wouldn't have similar feelings, similar ways of tackling problems in life. Mostly people accept today that that is so.
In writing about chimp behavior, you say that male chimps are more respectful of men, especially men with deep voices, and they take liberties with women. How did you find that out, and what kind of liberties did the chimps take with you?
Really, until quite recently, there hasn't been that obvious a difference in the way they treated male and female researchers. But we now have one chimpanzee who's a rogue, and he's actually very dangerous to female researchers, and most particularly to me. And it's very sad, after 32 years in the field, that one chimpanzee has, in a way, made Gombe feel a little unsafe to me today.
What does he do that's a threat to you?
He's probably 10 times stronger than I am. I mean, a big male chimp is said to be 4 to 5 times stronger than an adult human male. And Frodo is the largest, heaviest chimp we've ever known at Gombe. He's 115 pounds. He's about 20 years old. He's absolutely magnificent. He's one of Fifi's offspring. And what he'll do is display that's charging with his hair bristling, dragging branches and things, straight towards me, pull me over, stamp on me, perhaps display away, come back and do the same thing again. He's actually done it 3 times. He's not trying to kill me, but given the nature of the terrain, the steep, rugged slopes that drop down to riverbeds with rocks far below, you know, he's only got to tip me or someone else over the edge, and we've had it.
I'm sure you've asked yourself why you've become a target of his. Do you have any idea why?
I can only think that it's because of all the people working at Gombe, he has the least fear of me. I've always been able to get very close to even nervous individuals. And that's because I'm calm and quiet and I don't try to get too close and I don't push. And so he has absolutely no fear, no respect, no, you know, nothing that will block his aggressive behavior towards humans, particularly me.
I'm sure you've asked yourself what the chimps think of you and what they think of what you're doing there and who you are.
I doubt they think very much now. I think we're just part of the environment, as, you know, there are baboons and there are bush pigs. There used to be buffalo. They've gone now, sadly. But there are all kinds of other animals and birds. And we're just part of that natural environment, almost all of them. They grew up with us.
Did you learn to make the sounds that chimps use to communicate?
I can make most of them. Most of the people studying chimps can make those sounds, but we don't actually make them in the wild. I sometimes make them to chimps in captive groups, and they usually reply. Certainly that the little greeting sound, when you want to approach a nervous young chimp, which I have to do all the time, because one of the things that we're doing with the Institute is to rescue orphan chimps whose mothers have been shot by hunters. They're confiscated by the government and we care for them. And to see some of those pathetic little orphans in the markets being sold at the street side, they're dehydrated, their eyes are dull, they're losing hope, they're losing health. And you go up and you make this soft little which is a gentle greeting, and they'll sometimes put their arm around your neck.
How come you wouldn't use that language in the wild?
Because we've always tried to be as unobtrusive as possible, to keep in the background, to let the chimpanzees get on with their lives, not to try and communicate with them, but to be part of the environment that they will ignore. And, you know, apart from the occasional problem, such as with Frodo, that's the way it works. They accept us, they trust us, we can follow them, and they can get on with their lives.
What else would you say to a chimp in captivity?
Well, I sometimes make the distance call, which chimpanzees at Gombe make when they're calling out from one side of a valley to the other, and they're basically identifying themselves, or perhaps questioning, who's over there, I'm here.
Is that a sound you could demonstrate for us?
Well, I can demonstrate if I just lean away from the microphone, because it's rather loud, but...
How did you learn to do that? I mean, did you practice in the wild away from the chimps?
Well, I practiced away from the chimps.
So I imagine a lot of the researchers practice this on each other, huh?
Yeah. Well, sometimes if I'm giving a lecture and there's some of my students in the audience, I explain beforehand, you know, that I'm going to make this call and they're going to reply, and that always brings the house down.
In all your years in the field studying chimpanzees, were there particular aspects of chimp behavior that you felt you understood and were particularly like your own, particularly like the way humans behave?
Oh, I think a lot. One of the most striking, really, is the non-verbal communication patterns. So that chimpanzees will kiss, embrace, hold hands, pat one another on the back, swagger, threaten by shaking their fists, tickle. And the striking thing here is that not only do the patterns look like so many of ours, but they're used in the same context, so they obviously mean the same kind of thing.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jane Goodall, who is considered the world's foremost researcher on chimpanzees. She's co-authored a new book called Visions of Caliban on Chimpanzees and People. She's also the head of the Jane Goodall Institute to further work on conservation of chimpanzees worldwide, and that's based in Tucson. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Jane Goodall is my guest. When you first went to the bush, you were given the opportunity to do that by the anthropologist Louis Leakey, and this was to be the first really long-term study of chimpanzees. Other people, I believe, had studied them for months at a time. You were supposed to go there for a few years. So you got there, and you went with your mother because you weren't allowed to go by yourself? What was that story?
Young English women didn't do that sort of thing. In fact, as I grew up, I was told I couldn't. It's what I'd always wanted to do. But I had this great mother who always used to say, Jane, if you want to do something enough, and you work hard enough, and you take advantage of opportunities, you'll get there in the end. And so when I was told by the British authorities that it wouldn't be appropriate for me to go out completely on my own without some kind of female companion, my mother was the one who offered to come.
What did she do to help you when you were getting started?
Oh, she was fabulous. She had a clinic. Her brother was a surgeon, and he supplied her with all kinds of simple medications like aspirins and Band-Aids and Epsom salts, you know, that kind of thing, something mm-hmm. that anybody can administer. And she set up a little clinic on the shore of the lake for the local fishermen who were living around the park. And she had so much patience and so much concern and care that with these simple remedies, she sometimes worked wonderful, amazing cures. In fact, we found out later that she was known as the White Witch Doctor. And, of course, this was tremendously helpful in establishing friendly, good relationships with the local people, and those have remained ever since.
How long did she stay with you?
She was with me between 3 and 4 months, and by that time the local authorities realized that, you know, it was okay and I was going to be all right, and I had a staff by then. I had a cook and a boat driver, and I'd made friends with the local people, and they said, all right, you can stay.
When you got to Tanzania and you knew you were there to watch and research the chimps, were they easy to find?
No, they used to run away. The first moment they saw me, they would depart into the undergrowth. And it was very frustrating. But gradually, from an open rocky peak overlooking two valleys, one on the north and one on the south, using my binoculars, wearing the same colored clothes every day, they got used to this queer white-skinned ape who'd appeared so surprisingly in their midst. And so gradually I was able to get closer and closer and learn ever more about their fascinating behavior.
One chimp was particularly helpful to you because he was the first chimp that befriended you, shall we say. What did he do to help introduce you to the others?
He was fantastic. That was David Greybeard. And I probably owe more to him than any other chimp throughout these long 33 years. For some reason, he had a particularly calm and trusting disposition. Of course, every chimpanzee has his or her own totally individual personality, just like we do. And David, instead of running off, would just sit and calmly continue what he was doing. It was David who one day arrived in my camp to feed on the ripe fruits of the oil nut palm growing there. And while he was there, he saw some bananas lying on the table, and he took those. My cook told me about this male chimp who'd arrived, and eventually I stayed down and waited to see who it was, and then that's how I found out it was David Greybeard. I'd already named him from my encounters in the forest. And from that time on, he would sometimes wander up to me in the forest to see if I had a banana somewhere hidden about my person or in my haversack. And the other chimps would start to run, and then they'd stop, and their eyes were big and wide, and they think, what is this? What is going on? And so they realized that I wasn't so frightening after all. And it was as though David had opened a door into what was then a really magic unknown world.
What were the signs that you were being accepted by the other chimps?
They didn't run away. They stayed when I could approach, and they would look up. And then they'd continue their grooming or their playing or their feeding or whatever it was they were doing before I came.
Would they approach you and make friendly gestures toward you?
Oh, no. Absolutely not. They just continued with what they were doing.
Did it ever get to that point as time went on where chimps would come up to you and be friendly in a conscious way?
Well, you see, we tried to discourage all that kind of thing. They would sometimes come up to peer if there was a banana anywhere. But as we discouraged any kind of contact, we didn't really have that much. There was one short period. It was before I realized we could make this a really long-term study. And it was so exciting to be able to go up to and groom a completely wild adult male chimp, David Greybeard. It was so exciting when a mother allowed her infant to come up and touch me. It was so incredibly moving when a juvenile allowed me to play with him. And I wouldn't have foregone those experiences, but in a way they were wrong, because it was dangerous to try and establish communication with them. It was dangerous to the objective collection of information.
You become too much of the story and start to change the chimp behavior by your presence and involvement.
Yeah, I mean, it would be very easy to become part of the group, and then, for one, that would disturb the natural behavior more than we do by being there anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And for another, it could be very dangerous, because they do attack each other quite often for no very obvious reason sometimes. And they are very strong. And if we were perceived by them to be part of the group, they'd probably all treat all of us the way Frodo treats me.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that reminds me, I think about 15 years into your research, in the mid-70s, there was a war between two groups of chimps who you were studying, and one group was annihilated in that war. Did you know that that kind of fighting occurred?
No, we knew that the males of one social group, which we call a community, patrolled the boundaries of their territory. We knew that if they spied a stranger, they might chase, and if they caught up with that stranger, attack. We knew that they were sometimes extremely brutal to stranger females, but that there would be a sort of deliberate warfare where one by one the individuals of that small group were hounded down, brutally attacked, and left to die. That was a surprise, a bad surprise.
How were you able to watch it without getting hurt?
Because they weren't attempting to hurt us. They were completely concentrated on the victims. And because we have always made this conscious effort to remain outside their social life, they just ignored us. But it's very frightening to see chimpanzees so aggressive when you have 5 or 6 fully adult males attacking one victim. It's extremely brutal. And it teaches us that just as chimpanzees have very many of the characteristics that we see in ourselves of compassion and love and altruism, so too can they show a dark side of their nature.
What's their method of fighting?
It's stamping, sometimes biting, dragging along the ground. Those are the main components.
Were you at first gravely disappointed that the chimps had the potential to be as violent as we know people can be?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I used to think, well, they're very like people, but nicer. And then I realized that when opportunity arises, they have this nasty, brutal side to them, just like we do.
You know, when humans fight a war, you always want to know, what is the war about? What is the motivation? Who is wronging who? When chimps fight a war, what is it about?
Well, this particular war is the only one we've ever seen, and we're not too sure. I think we shan't be very sure until it happens again. But I think it was because one main community divided. It just got rather a lot of males, and they divided into two. And the smaller section took over what had been the southern part of the range when the community was one. And I think it was simply that the larger number of males wanted to regain access to that part of the territory that they lost after the split. And indeed, after they'd annihilated the smaller fragment of the community, you know, in something rather like a civil war, they did move with their females back into that piece of land that they'd lost.
Jane Goodall is my guest. Let me move to some human violence that happened in the 70s in your camp. 4 student researchers in your camp were kidnapped by Zairean guerrillas. How did you find out what had happened?
It took long, agonizing days before one of the students was sent back. She was able to tell what had happened. She brought the demands of the kidnappers with her.
What were the demands?
They wanted money, and they wanted various things like publicity. They wanted arms. They did not get the arms. Of course, they got the publicity. I mean, it was all over the international press. And they got some money. But the main thing was that the students were returned and they were all safe.
Was that the only time anyone in your group had been the victim of human violence?
Yes, and you see, if you imagine how lucky I was, because so many of my colleagues who've been studying primates or other kinds of animals in Africa and Asia and South America have had to stop their research, have actually been in physical danger because of political unrest. I mean, it's happened again and again and again. Tanzania, apart from that one incident, it's been peaceful. It has been the most politically stable government in the whole of Black Africa.
The site of your research has been a national park in Tanzania. How has the wild changed since 1960 when you started your research?
Unbelievably, and I wish on radio one could actually show pictures, because I have some pictures showing what it was like along the shore of the lake for maybe 100 miles in 1960. And if you go back there today and you go along the 10-mile strip of Gombe shoreline, it's only 10 miles long, this little national park, it looks exactly the same. But if you go to the north or the south, the forested hills, which used to come down to the water green and lush with a few little clearings for the fishermen growing their crops, today there are no trees. It isn't that there's a lot of deforestation, it's that these slopes are completely bare. And the frightening thing is, you say to yourself, well, what's happened? What does this mean? It means that the chimpanzees and the other forest animals have long since gone, apart from a few tiny, pathetic remnant groups that are in the very, very steepest valleys. And then you see how the fishermen have been trying to cultivate these inappropriate steep slopes. You see that every time it rains, the topsoil, this precious thin layer, is washed down into the lake. You realize that the fish breeding grounds in the shallows are being silted up. And you realize that in 5-6 years, if we can't help them in some way, the people will be starving and gone too. And yet there's nowhere for them to go because of increased population and because of refugees coming from Burundi and Zaire. I mean, it's a nightmare situation.
What's left of the chimp population that you've been studying?
The chimps that we've been studying within the park are completely safe, and they're not in danger of poaching, so that as far as wild chimps goes, they live in a kind of paradise. And that, I think, is because we have employed Tanzanian field staff from the villages around the park, not just in menial capacities as trackers or to help us around camp, but they follow the chimps. They make detailed written reports. They use 8mm video cameras. They're very proud of their work. They care about the chimps. They'll look after them if they're sick. They talk about them to their family and friends in the villages. And so, you see, there's no danger of poaching. Plus, by doing this, we're helping the local economy with the wages that we pay.
Jane Goodall, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jane Goodall co-wrote the new book Visions of Caliban on Chimpanzees and People. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Scientists are monitoring mysterious illnesses in the American Southwest and Cuba. These illnesses may be caused by new viral strains. Coming up, we talk with epidemiologist Robert Shope, editor of a recent report for the Institute of Medicine on new strains of viruses and bacteria threatening the United States. The report concludes that the threat of new microbial infections may intensify in coming years, and we can't afford to be complacent. And world music commentator Milo Miles reviews the debut album by Pakistani singer and songwriter Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. According to UN officials, 5 UN peacekeepers have been killed and more than 40 others wounded in military action in Somalia. Among the dead are said to be 4 Moroccans and a Pakistani soldier. The president is expected to address the situation in Somalia at his news conference, slated to begin 1.5 hour from now. In Somalia, UN troops have been engaged in day-long air and ground attacks on a factional leader and his supporters. General Mohammed Adid is accused of planning an attack that killed 23 Pakistani peacekeepers earlier this month. U.S. and Pakistani soldiers stormed the general's two-story home and office today, only to find it deserted. Bosnia's Muslim president has called totally unacceptable a plan to divide Bosnia into 3 ethnic states. The plan was advanced by leaders of Croatia and Serbia during peace talks in Geneva. But international mediator David Owen called on the Bosnian leadership to look at the plan very seriously. Peter Biles, the BBC, reports from Geneva.
Lord Owen said the new proposals for dividing Bosnia were not the Vance-Owen plan, and it would be dishonest to describe them as such. He said the situation in Bosnia was deteriorating, the provisional map had been torn up by all 3 parties to the conflict, and they would now have to look at anything which might provide a fair and just peace. In despondent mood, Lord Owen admitted that his original plan for keeping Bosnia together had now failed.
There won't be a lot of honour, and there won't be anywhere near the sort of settlement that I would have ideally liked, and I don't make any secret of that.
Lord Owen said, however, that it was still too early to evaluate the alternative plan for Bosnia until more details emerged, and he said it remained to be seen how many good parts of the Vance-Owen plan could be rescued.
Peter Boyles in Geneva. The Senate has approved a measure which places voluntary limits on the amount of money political candidates may spend on congressional races and bans contributions from political action committees. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
By a vote of 60-38, the Senate approved a bill that transforms the way congressional campaigns are financed. The key elements are voluntary limits on spending, ranging from $1.2 million to $5.5 million, depending on the size of the state. Candidates who don't observe the caps will be levied a 34% tax on his or her campaign coffers, with the money going to the candidate who does observe the limits. Oklahoma Democrat David Boren was the floor manager of the bill.
Politicians, people elected to the Congress, have voted against their self-interest. They voted to change a system which helps keep them in office. They voted to give challengers a greater chance in the political process.
The bill now goes to the House, where Democrats say they will pass their own version of campaign finance reform. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the Capitol.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 10 points in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. Leaders of Russia and Ukraine have agreed to divide the Black Sea Fleet into separate navies. The move is still subject to ratification by the parliaments of the 2 former Soviet republics. For more than a year now, Ukraine and Russia have been arguing over the fleet, one of the most powerful in the world, with some 350 ships and 70,000 sailors. Talks had broken off in April, leading to disputes over pay differences and divided loyalties. President Clinton is recommending a scale-back version of the space station. The president says it will save $18 billion over the projected 20-year life of the program. In a written statement, Mr. Clinton said the changes will preserve the program's space and science research, but make the best use of every dollar. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
President Clinton has decided to keep 2 high-tech science projects alive. The president is expected to reaffirm his support for the Super Collider project, and today he announced his commitment to the planned space station. The president had asked NASA for a review of the space station. In a written statement released today, the president said NASA met that challenge by offering a plan that reduces costs to taxpayers, improves management, preserves research, and allows the United States to continue its work with the international community. The review concluded that significant cost savings could be achieved, but only with management changes at NASA, and that international participation would benefit the program. The redesign is estimated to save $8 to $9 billion through the year 2000. The White House will request $2.1 billion for the program for fiscal 1994. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
The nation's trade deficit grew in April to nearly $10.5 billion, its biggest figure in more than 4 years. The Commerce Department says consumers were buying more oil and cars from overseas in April. The nation's trade deficit with Japan jumped 4.4% to $5.5 billion. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. A mysterious disease is being monitored in the American Southwest. 24 cases have been reported. 12 of those people have died. The symptoms include high fever, muscle aches, cough, and fluid in the lungs that can result in suffocation. Preliminary lab findings suggest that the disease may be caused by a virus spread by rats. Are new viruses heading our way? We called Yale epidemiologist Dr. Robert Shope. He co-chaired a committee on emerging microbial threats to health and edited the committee's report to the Institute of Medicine. If the disease in the Southwest is a virus, would it be a new virus or a new strain of an existing virus?
Well, it would be a relative, sort of like a first cousin of some viruses that are known. And these are called hantaviruses. The most famous of these viruses is the cause of the Korean hemorrhagic fever, which afflicted our troops in the 1950s in Korea.
If the disease in the Southwest is being caused by a strain of the hantavirus, which has never been known to kill people in the United States before, what would the implications be?
Well, the implications would be that we have a focus of the disease in this area. If our evidence is correct, it's probably localized. In other words, it may be over a relatively wide area in New Mexico and Arizona, but it's not likely to be in very far from there, and it's not likely to spread from there.
The hantavirus is carried by rats and rodents, right?
Yes.
What would the explanation be for how a new strain developed here? I mean, Would it be a rat that came from another country aboard a fruit crate or something? What are the possible explanations?
Probably not. No, probably it's this is a genus of viruses, a set of viruses that has evolved with rodents. It's probably been there for a long, long time, maybe centuries or more than centuries, and as other forms of life evolve, so do viruses. And they go along with their rodent.
So in the new strain of virus that we think we're seeing in the Southwest, it just might be a kind of like natural evolution of the virus?
It's probably been there for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And probably something has changed in the ecology of the area.
And why would that change the virus? I mean, why would that make us more susceptible to the virus?
It doesn't change the virus, and it doesn't make us more susceptible. What it does, let's say, for instance, that the factor that's changed is the food supply of the rodents. That's one of the hypotheses that's being explored right now. If the food supply of the rodents increases, that will permit the population of rodents to increase. Since there would be more rodents, it's a numbers game. There might be more chances of people coming into contact. And that could lead to an unusual number of cases or an epidemic.
You say they're exploring whether the food source for rodents has changed. And apparently Navajo tribal elders say that for the first time in the memory, the pinyon trees had nuts through the year and the rats feed on those nuts.
Well, yes, that's what the newspaper and television has been telling us, and And very often, when new diseases appear, the people in the area where the diseases occur have some idea about what's responsible. They may not understand why, but we as epidemiologists listen to the local folk.
Mm-hmm. When I think about viruses spreading to new parts of the world they hadn't existed in before, what I immediately think of is travel, you know, that people are traveling more than ever and that, you know, the world is shrinking. Does that have anything to do with that, or is that just common wisdom that doesn't really hold up?
No, it does hold up. If one travels into an area today, for instance, where there's a virus disease, one can become infected. The virus has an incubation period in a person or in an animal, and if with our modern travel we can return very quickly, or within 24 hours from most parts of the world, we can get to the United States. So we could be infected one place, return to the United States, and be able to spread the virus. Fortunately, most viruses require very precise conditions in which to spread, so that the conditions in the United States are going to be different from the conditions overseas. And that's the usual series of events. That is, that people become infected, they return to the United States, and they don't start any epidemic. However, an unlikely event can occur, and we know unlikely events do occur and will occur, in which the agent will spread.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Robert Shope, an epidemiologist at Yale University Medical School. He was also on the Committee on Emerging Microbial Threats to Health of the Institute of Medicine that released a report on emerging infections. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Talking about the new spread of diseases, my guest is Yale epidemiologist Robert Shope. You edited a report on emerging infections. It was a report by the Committee on Emerging Microbial Threats to Health for the Institute of Medicine. And this report warned that there was an increasing threat of viruses to the United States, and that basically we were letting down our guard. What led you to that conclusion?
We had a committee of 19 persons, specialists in infectious diseases, and it was the first thing that led us to the conclusion was the common experience of the people on the committee, and we're able to document that infections are increasing. For instance, use of antibiotics in the United States and in the world, not just the United States, but the use of antibiotics has increased dramatically over the past three decades. The antibiotics against bacteria lead to an evolution of the bacteria to become resistant to the antibiotics. So this is one of the things that's happening. We're also seeing diseases like HIV disease, and I think probably AIDS was one of the major stimulating factors for us to look at why new diseases are appearing and what we can do about them.
Well, you think the United States has let down its guard. What aren't we doing now that we used to do to track new microbial threats?
Well, we went through an era in which we developed a number of new vaccines. We developed new antibiotics, and this led us to complacency, and understandably so. We really thought that infectious diseases were conquered and were a thing of the past. I think most of us understood the principles that the organisms would eventually mutate or change and outwit us again, but we turned to try to conquer other things in science, and we've now come to realize that we can't give up. We can't turn to other things. We can do other things, but we can't forget the infectious agents. They're with us.
How are viruses tracked around the world? What kind of surveillance programs do we have?
Around the world, we have some networks of laboratories that are linked through the World Health Organization. We also have networks of diagnostic facilities that are linked to individual governments. The United States, for instance, maintains military laboratories, which are very well equipped and staffed. An example is a laboratory in Bangkok, Thailand. We also maintain research programs through the National Institutes of Health in various tropical countries. The French government has a similar set of laboratories, for instance, especially in French West Africa, so that there is a way to find new viruses. Unfortunately, we don't have enough. And
enough what?
We don't have enough listening posts.
Mm-hmm.
We now know that AIDS was present in Africa long before we recognized what it was, and that's only one example. We probably could find the diseases more rapidly than we do, and learn what they are and be ready for them.
You said if our surveillance was better of infections around the world, we'd be better prepared for them. What could we do to be prepared?
Oh, there are several things that we can do. One class of agents that is a threat are the mosquito-borne and agents that are carried by other arthropods, such as ticks. In a generic sense, we need to be ready to control insects and ticks. We need research on new pesticides. We need increased monitoring with the existing pesticides to make sure that the biting flying arthropods or the biting arthropods are not becoming resistant to them. That's one thing. Second thing that we need to do is to have an infrastructure in our vaccine industry, which is capable of reacting rapidly in the manufacturing of vaccines. This, I think, is very important. Right now, if we have to rely on commercial firms, which have a profit motive naturally, to produce a new vaccine, it takes a disaster. There has to be a big market out there for the vaccine before the companies can afford to do it.
What kind of reaction did you get to the report that you edited that said we're letting down our guard in the surveillance of new infections?
We've had a very positive reaction. One thing that happened immediately was that the initial printing of the report sold out, and it had to be reprinted, which, in fact, sold out sooner than any report that the Institute of Medicine has ever put out. So that we knew that people were interested in the subject. The Centers for Disease Control has reacted by developing a very interesting and very comprehensive plan for monitoring and reacting to new diseases in the United States, And they also have some plans for overseas monitoring. The National Institutes of Health has adopted the concept of emerging diseases in its research program. And I think that you will see an increase in research in the United States in this area.
So you think your criticism is getting results?
I think so, yes. The moment of truth will come when we see whether new resources flow into this area.
Dr. Shope, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, you're welcome. I've enjoyed it.
Dr. Robert Shope is a professor of epidemiology at Yale University School of Medicine. He edited a report for the Institute of Medicine on emerging infections. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll have some news from Somalia. The head of the UN mission there, retired U.S. Admiral Jonathan Howe, has announced that the UN now intends to arrest the most powerful warlord in Mogadishu, General Idid, and to make him stand trial for war crimes, for acts that were committed or that he organized just this month in Mogadishu that involved in part firing on Pakistani peacekeepers and subsequent acts. We'll be talking with Admiral Howe, also hearing about U.S. policy here in Washington, what President Clinton had to say today about the future of the space station, and our listeners' letters about Ghetto Life 101 and the rising intonation.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In world music, it's sometimes hard to find the ideal album to introduce a performer to American audiences. Commentator Milo Miles says he's found one for Pakistan's Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan.
Let's face it, some types of world music are easier for Americans to understand than others. The tones, melodies, and rhythms of Europe and the African diaspora are already embedded in our pop music, so we have a head start on songs from those places. Asia, on the other hand, is musical terra incognita. And that's too bad, because one of the most glorious performers anywhere is singer Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, the master of Qawwali. What, you ask, is Qawwali? Well, the top of the 12th century hit parade for the Muslim faithful were Sufi hymns sung by wandering musicians. Both they and their music were called Qawwali. During the next 8 centuries, the Qawwali pulled the soul music trick and added secular love songs to their repertoire. They played fewer sacred shrines and more weddings. In that spirit, Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan has made an album called Devotional and Love Song that should thrill dedicated fans and rank outsiders alike.
Yeah.
Nusrat's backup band features a uniquely Qawwali lineup. There are two other lead voices besides Nusrat and a four-man chorus who do a lot of hand clapping. One member plays tabla drums from India and two others hold forth on the harmonium, a kind of hand-pumped organ that can produce drones or horn-like riffs. A crucial addition to the Devotional and Love Songs album is the guitar or mandolin accompaniment of Majwar Abbas. His work fills out the Qawwali sound and gives it an agreeable, folkish feel. Nusrat is no less formidable, but much more congenial. The enduring exhilaration of any Nusrat recording is the interaction of his voice with his group. They pass leads around like an NBA team in showtime. Nusrat will repeat and vary a phrase until it becomes a mantra, pure sound. Or he'll burst out with startling wordless phrases that sound remarkably like an improvising saxophonist. Or he'll engage in naughty give and take with the tabla or guitar. The energy is athletic, sensuous, and reverent all at once. The Sufi sect says that joy is the essential emotion in love, in worship, and in life itself. There's no finer exponent of that philosophy than Nusrat Khan.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Boston. He reviewed Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan's new album, Devotional and Love Songs, on the Real World label. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Voblaitis, Ron Barron, Chris Fraley, and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In the film Airplane, he played the loony doctor, and in the Naked Gun movies, he was the deadpan police lieutenant. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Leslie Nielsen about his totally made-up life story. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.